How many of you ever cruise around on the internet or you know, you get on the internet, whatever the language is that you're supposed to use in talking about. But anyway, get on the internet and just punch in something, perhaps some biblical phrase like mark of the beast, and see what comes up. You ever do that? Anybody? If you do that one in particular, you'll see a whole lot of stuff comes up, won't you? I mean, a lot of stuff. And they're all over the place. Everybody and his brother knows exactly what the mark of the beast is. You know, it's everything from some implanted computer chip, or it may be a particular day of the week that people are commanded to keep. That's popular in the Seventh-day Adventist church, as well as within Church of God circles. It may be something else, like some form of currency, or something to do with technology, or maybe it may be the vaccine. Have you heard that one? There are people who think that the mark of the beast is the vaccine, and okay, they're entitled to their opinion. Everybody's entitled to their opinion. Well, I'm going to talk about that today, and the title of the sermon is Missing the Mark. Pun intended, missing the mark, because I do think a lot of people overlook a lot of things. I'd like to begin, though, by telling you about an experience that I had. It's a good many years back, and I'll mention this because I don't think anybody in this room except possibly Charles, maybe I think he's the only one probably that know the people that I'm going to be talking about. Just stating it briefly, I'm not going to get into the full extent of what was going on there, but it seems that a small group of people in another state, not here, decided that they wanted to leave the CGI. And that's perfectly fine. We understand the Church of God International is not the Church of God, that you can still be a member of the Church of God without being a member of the CGI. We all understand that, that the Church of God, the true church, is not confined to anybody's particular denominational or organizational boundaries. So they decided they want to leave. I knew why. I know why, what the real reason was. It had to do with some squabble between individuals and some misunderstanding and some hurt feelings and things like that that happen. That kind of thing happens all the time and to just about everybody at some time or another. But anyway, that was the real reason, and it kind of escalated. And it didn't involve me. Didn't involve me at all until... someone decided that they didn't want to reveal the real reasons they were leaving, so they decided to take a look at what was going on in Tyler. And this kind of thing happens. Sometimes when people split, when divorces take place, when organizations split, new churches form, sometimes, not always, but sometimes people come up with reasons other than the real reasons that they're leaving for. This happens, doesn't it? We all know that. But in any case, this is what happened here. And so the reason I got involved in it was because I made the, well, I guess now looking back, maybe mistake. I don't really think it's a mistake of answering somebody's email. I won't get into the subject, the topic, what it was. It was really not a doctrinal issue. It's nothing. The issue had nothing to do with anything that is anywhere in any of our statement of beliefs. It's not there. They asked the question, again, not going to get into it, and my answer was, my guess is. Now, it was a question on what do people in CGI believe about this certain topic. Again, an opinion-type topic, not a doctrinal issue, at least not anything I'd ever put in doctrinal category. And so they wanted to know what people thought, and I said, my guess is. You know what that means, my guess is? It means that there's a certain element of uncertainty there. I'm not completely certain, but my guess is that this is what most people believe. And then I explained it. Email comes back and said, we had no idea the Church of God International taught that. I said, no. Church of God International doesn't teach that. You ask me about what do people live. I said, my guess is, my assumption is, I think, because I'd heard discussion on it before, I think this is what most believe. But the Church of God has no formal statement on it whatsoever. Well, somehow or other, that got all twisted, and it eventually it morphed into something never was till I heard at some point that that Tyler, meaning primarily me, I don't know how, to what extent Charles was included at that point, or Bronson, who was here at the time, but Tyler was supporting the, not the Mark of the Beast, but the was supporting Baal worship because of certain things that they were teaching, meaning basically what I was teaching, which I wasn't. But anyway, to make a long story short, I was at the feast one year, and this was sometime after all of that, and I thought it's so much water under the bridge at this point, and time heals, you know, and people forget about things like that and go on with their lives. And then I gave the sermon. The sermon was entitled, How Love I Thy Law, and is one of the many that I have done on the subject of the law and its relationship to the Christian and to the New Covenant, some of the typical kinds of things that I've done many times in the past. And then after the sermon, someone approaches me and begins to fire these questions at me. Well, can someone be saved without keeping the law and all that? And, of course, the kind of answer I would give is that, like, well, keeping the law is not what causes your salvation. But certainly, if you know what to do, if you know what God requires as stated in the law, and you don't do it willfully, then you can lose your salvation as a result. Well, okay, that's satisfying. Then here comes another question. Turns around, comes back, another question. Then a little crowd starts together, the little group that's planning on leaving for another reason, and they start firing these questions. Now, here comes the big one. Here comes the big one. I think this is the one, this is the real fellowship question. Do you know what the mark of the beast is? That was the question that was given to me. And, you know, they were not able to get me with anything that the fire, they were looking, I know what they were doing, I knew what they were doing, I figured it out pretty quickly, that they were looking for to pull something out of me they could use to confirm what they were saying about Tyler. And so they never were able to, but I finally gave it to them. Do you know what the mark of the beast is? I said, no. And the guy says, what? You're from Tyler and you don't know what the mark of the beast is? Very animated, maybe not that much, but he was animated about it. I said, that's right. I'm admitting to ignorance. I don't know. Now, the truth is, I do know what it is. I know what the Bible says it is. It's very clear. It's not hidden in the text. It's not a mystery. It's not hard to understand. But what I meant when I said I don't know, because I knew what he had in mind, when I said I don't know, and that is I don't know if the mark will have a particular manifestation at some point in time that is something that's not stated on the surface of the text. That's what I meant. And it's possible that that may be. But the text is pretty clear on what the mark of the beast is. Well, others join the conversation, and one fellow chimes in, and he starts telling me how clear it is. And, of course, his position was, you've all heard it before, that it was the enforcement of Sunday, a Sunday law. And that's the mark of the beast. And how do you come up with that? So, well, it was explained to me like I'd never heard this before. But it was explained that, well, look, the beast, everything you see, the beast and the false prophet, all of these are counterfeits of the truth. You know, the devil is a counterfeit of God the Father. The beast that comes out of the sea is a counterfeit of Jesus Christ, and so on. You have all these counterfeits. So the beast has his mark. He has a mark. Now, does God have a mark? Does he have something that identifies him as the mark identifies the beast and the beast's followers? What mark of God or a sign of God that identifies the followers and disciples of Jesus Christ or the people who worship the true God? Well, you go back there to the Old Testament, as the argument goes, let the Bible interpret the Bible, which is really not what you're doing. But anyway, you go back there and you find, sure enough, there's a sign back there. Guess what it is? You know what it is. What day is it? The sign is the Sabbath. So what is the mark of the beast? That's the sign that identifies the beast's followers. If God's worshipers are identified by the Sabbath, if that's the sign that God has given them. Oh, so it's a counterfeit Sabbath. It's Sunday. Or more specifically, the enforcement of Sunday observance. How many of you have never heard that? Anybody? How many of you have heard that? Raise your, yeah. Now, Larry or Charles could correct me, but I seem to remember that back in the days, back in the old worldwide days, many years ago, that there was that was not the only view that was ever presented, that there were other views that were speculated about. I think maybe the German currency or something like that had to do with the mark. I don't know if either one of them remember that far back. It was a long time ago. But in any case, as I recall, there was quite a bit of speculation about the mark of the beast, and I don't think that particular idea was ever considered a dogmatic or doctrinal statement, even though it was presented that Sunday, or the enforcement of Sunday worship, was the mark of the beast. That's definitely a teaching in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. They're really big on that. And if you want somebody to expound it and make the best case argument for it, then go to their material. They've been doing this for over 100 years, so they know how to answer all the objections. But in any case, that was the argument. And the one fellow chimes in. He goes in. He explains all of those things to me. And he concludes with saying, "It's got to be." Now, this is not one of the same little group that was planning to leave. But he said, "It's got to be that. It can't be anything else." He was very dogmatic about it. And I thought, well, okay. And I didn't, I'm not going to take issue with that. If that's what someone comes up with, that's the best they can do, fine. That's not at all up to me or for me to take issue with it. I don't want to take issue with that. That's his position, and he made his case, and it is convincing to him. But going all the way back when I first heard that that argument, it never was convincing to me. And that's to me. If you're convinced of it, that's fine. You don't need to leave. No, if you're convinced of it, that's fine. I respect that. But it never was convincing to me, that whole argument. And even the Adventist material, and they know how to present it in the most plausible way, it has never been convincing either. But as I said, I do know what it is, and we'll talk about that a little bit. But I want to go back a little bit here in chapter 13. That's going to be our text for the day, in Revelation chapter 13. And if my voice will let me, I'm going to read just through this, hopefully quickly, and then maybe comment on a few points here along the way. And then we'll get to what it is, what the mark of the beast is, and then I'll give you my opinion as to what the text is actually saying. I'm going to give you some context here. I'm not going to go back to some other text over in Exodus or someplace. I'm not going to go elsewhere to pull out text to interpret this. I'm going to let the text itself speak. And then I'll give you my opinion based on that, with the qualifier that there may, at the end of the day, be more to it than I can readily see. Okay? So Revelation 13, "And I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 diadems on its horns and blasphemous names on its heads. The beast that I saw was like a leopard, its feet were like a bear's, and its mouth was like a lion's mouth, and to it the dragon," this would be the devil, already defined as Satan the devil, "the dragon gave his power and his throne and great authority." Now understand that the description of the beast here, the beast that comes out of the sea, is very, very similar to the description of the dragon. 7 heads, 10 horns, and so on. So he bears the image of the dragon, the image and the likeness of the dragon. So I can see that how people naturally conclude that this is a counterfeit of God the Father and Jesus Christ. Because the beast from the sea, is the devil's agent here. He's going to be doing the devil's work. Whoever this beast is going to be doing the devil's work on earth. And that involves persecuting the people of God and killing them, insofar as that is possible. And he goes on to describe it further. "And to it the dragon gave the power and his throne and great authority. One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed, and the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast. And they worshiped the dragon, and he had given his authority to the beast, for he had given his authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like the beast and who can fight against it? And the beast was given a mouth uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. Now, elsewhere in Revelation, you see this description of 1260 days. You also see time, times, and half a time. And this is obviously referring, or I say obvious, it seems obvious, I'll put it that way. I don't like to be very conclusive on anything like this, but it seems obvious that that's referring to the same period. And 1260 days, that's 3.5 years. Now, does this mean actually 1260 days? How many of you are familiar with something called the day for the year principle? The day for the year principle. How many of you can prove from the Bible that there is such a principle? And it's to apply to prophetic days every time you read about prophetic days. You cannot prove that. That's another one of those things that does not have proof. You can make perhaps a plausible case that it may apply in certain cases, but there is no universally applied day for a year principle. But the Adventist interpretation, and for that matter, the interpretations of almost all the reformers going way back, depends on it. In other words, if the day for a year principle is not true, then their whole prophetic scenario falls apart. And the idea is based on Numbers 14:34 and Ezekiel 4 and verse 6. A couple of scriptures there. There may be one more possibly, but those two especially. And that's where a day represents a year. You know, Ezekiel lays on his side for what is 390 days, and each day represented a year of the punishment that was due to Israel. And in Numbers 14, that's the 40 days that they spied out the land. That was the number of years. That would be the number of years that God would cause Israel to remain in the wilderness and not allow them to go into the land. So that does not establish a universal principle that's always to be applied in prophet when you read about days in prophecy. That's guesswork, entirely guesswork. So the idea here is, though, that this beast, I'll give you the Adventist understanding of the beast, then I'll talk about some other understandings and show how that none of them really have strong support, I don't think. And that is the beast is the papacy, because the papacy, and you can look up the dates or you can come up with dates, as the Adventists and others have, it was prominent for it. In other words, the papal reign continued for 1260 years. So, it fits nicely. It fits very nicely. 1260 years. So if you can come up with that, sometimes you may have to tinker with the numbers a little bit to get an exact figure like that. But 1260 years or 42 months, time, times, and half a time. That's the length of the existence of the reign of the papacy, and it came to an end. However, it's going to rise again, show its power again through another beast, as we read here. That's the idea from the Adventist point of view. But again, I take exception to that. Now, our point of view has been that this is a United States of Europe of some sort that will rise in the end time, consisting of 10 nations. Not taking issue with that, that may well be. But I will say this, there's more to it than that. More to it than that. But it goes on, it opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Also, it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them, and authority was given it over every tribe and people and language and nation. That is pretty universal, I would say. And all who dwell on earth will worship it, everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb that was slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to be taken captive to captivity, he goes. If anyone is to be slain with a sword, he must be slain. And here comes the big point, the main point of all of this. This is a major theme and a main purpose for Revelation itself. Here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints. So whatever this beast turns out to be, it doesn't really matter at the end of the day if you're applying this. It is a persecuting power. We see that. Whatever it is, whatever manifestation it takes, then this is the key. This is what the people of God are called upon to do. Persist in faith. That's what it means. Now then, what do you think the churches in Asia, by the way, that was the target audience. This, it's interesting when you look at who this was written to. We just assume, sometimes we just make assumptions or don't make any assumption at all, and we see ourselves as the target audience. But this book was written to the seven churches in Asia, and there really were seven literal churches in Asia at that time. It was sent to them, and they were to read it. The people who did the reading would read it before the congregation. Now, what do you think those people in the seven churches of Asia thought when they heard this description? Do you think they scratched their heads and did they say, what does this mean? And what did John mean? What did John think when he heard this description? And when he wrote it down, did he think, well, God is telling me, like he told Daniel, go your way, John, for the vision is sealed until the time of the end? No, that's not what he told him at all. I'll tell you, I've said this before, but I tell you, when they heard this, the people of Asia Minor heard this description, when John received it, he knew immediately, they knew right away what it was talking about. I don't think there's any hesitancy there. Yeah, of course, because they had been experiencing it. They knew what these symbols were. And they saw this thing. It was alive and well then. It's not something exclusively for the end time. I'd like for you to just hold your place here before we go on to the second beast there and go back to Revelation chapter 1, to remember this. It's very important. It says the revelation. That does not mean the sealing, does it? Revelation. The apocalypse. It's not referring to a sealing, but an unveiling. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show to his servants, the things which must, in a long, great long while from now, many years from now, take place. Is that what it says? In my Bible, it says soon. Soon take place. What did that mean to the people who first heard this? When the reader stood up before the congregations in Asia Minor and read these words, did they think, oh, that's for the future, we can't understand it? I know it's called the unveiling of Jesus Christ for things that will soon take place, but we cannot. No, they didn't think that at all. They think this is for us. And guess what? It was for them. It doesn't mean that it was only for them. Remember it says to each of the churches. Let he who hears hear what the Spirit says to the churches. So anybody who hears, who has ears to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. So it's anybody who hears it, because there is an application for people outside and after the first century. But in any case, it goes on to say, he made it known by sending the angel to his servant John, who bore witness to the word of God and to the testimony of Jesus Christ, even to all that he saw. Blessed is the one who reads aloud the words, this would be the guy at the front of the congregation, of this prophecy, and blessed are those who hear, that would be the congregation, and who keep what is written in it, for the time is far off. No, the time is near. So they knew exactly what this seven-headed, ten-horned beast that came out of the sea was all about. They identified, they recognized him immediately, I say. In fact, they knew the concept that was extant at that time, that the abyss, which is down beneath the floor of the ocean, was the habitation of evil. I'm not saying that's literally true, but that was a concept. And so here you have the devil standing on the sand of the sea, and the devil is summoning his agent, his chief agent, out of the sea. Guess where he comes from? Out of the habitation of evil. And he comes forth, and what is he to do? He's to persecute the saints. He's to do the devil's bidding on earth. And he bears the image and the likeness of the devil himself. So however you wish to define the beast, I don't think there's any question about it, how these people define the beast. Now there will be, I think, I'll show you this a little later, but there will be a latter day manifestation of that. Well, I'll show it to you now so we don't have to go back to that. I'll forget it later if I don't do it now. But in Revelation chapter 19, just briefly, let's go over there. Revelation chapter 19, again, holding your place in chapter 13. I was going to read through that in a hurry, but it's not as much of a hurry as I anticipated at first. But anyway, he says, Revelation 19, you see I'm not going to read all this. You see the second coming of Jesus Christ that's taking place there. Starting in verse 13, he is clothed in a robe dipped in blood, and the name by which he is called is the Word of God. He's not God the Father, as some people have suggested. This is the Word, the revelation of God the Father, as part of one of his names. And the armies in heaven, arrayed in fine linen, white and pure, were following him on white horses. Now from his mouth comes a sharp sword with which to strike down the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron. He will tread the winepress of the fury and wrath of Almighty God. Think about the imagery of that. Think about the imagery. He treads the winepress. Have you ever seen anybody treading a winepress? Yeah, what he's talking about here is treading the winepress. These are humans in there. And not literal, but it is very, very descriptive, and it's kind of gruesome when you think about it, isn't it? You see, imagine them being crushed underfoot, and that's what's going on here, and the blood is, you know, like the fruit of the vine is gushing out. It's kind of gruesome. The next time you hear somebody say, you know, I like Jesus, but that God of the Old Testament is too furious and too wrathful for me, just show them this text. But anyway, he treads the winepress of the fierceness and the wrath of God the Almighty. On his robe and on his thigh he has a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And then let's skip on down to verse 19. And I saw the beast. There he is again. Now when is this? This is not first century any longer, is it? This is at the second coming of Christ. It's just before the beginning of the millennium. I saw the beast and the kings of the earth with their armies gathered to make war against him who was sitting on the horse and against his army. And the beast was captured, and with it the false prophet. That's the second beast we're going to read about in just a moment, who in its presence has done the signs for which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped its image. So they're cast alive into the lake of fire. So this, you see that a manifestation of this same system is alive and well in the time of the end. Okay? Now what was the beast in its original form? It's very clear. It was the Roman Empire. No question about that. It fits the description very well, and this is how the people would have recognized it. I'm not going into detail and explaining how that is, but just look at the description, compare with Daniel, and I think you'll see it. But in any case, this was in its original form, its original manifestation, the Roman Empire. Now we come to that second beast. What about it? Verse 11, and I saw another beast rising out of the earth. This one doesn't come out of the sea. It comes out of the earth, perhaps because of its association with the people. It rises out of the land. That's where people dwell. It had two horns like a lamb. Perhaps the emphasis here is like a lamb. It's lamb-like in some way. And it spoke like a dragon. You see, there's a combination there. I'm not so sure it's a good combination. I'm sure it's not a good combination. In some ways, it seems to be saying that in some ways, it's like the lamb. Who's that in Revelation? Jesus Christ. But also, in some ways, it's like the dragon. And who is that? The devil. In other words, it may appear lamb-like. It may appear to be a lamb. It may appear to be Christ-like. And yet, it has these features that are satanic. It's a deceiver. And it goes on to show that this is a force of deception. It says it exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence and makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast whose mortal wound was healed. Of course, that's a counterfeit, perhaps, of the death and resurrection of Christ. But in any case, he goes on to say it performs great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to earth in front of people. And by the signs that it is allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those who dwell on the earth. That's its purpose. He deceives people. But why does it do that? What is the point here? Understand that when you're talking about the beast here, you're talking about a totalitarian system. This is totalitarianism. Some of the Roman emperors were definitely dictators. And what always occurs in totalitarianism? Always, without fail. Totalitarians or dictators always enlist propagandists. They always control the media. So here you have a totalitarian power that is controlling information that comes to people. He has his propagandists supporting him. And that's what this second beast obviously represents. Let's read on. It was allowed to give breath, verse 15, to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast might even speak and might cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain. Also, it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead. This is what the propagandist is doing. He's the supporter, the promoter of the beast. So that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark, that is, the name of the beast or the number of its name. You see here that this is the guy or the system that is promoting the beast, the propagandist. And then he goes on to say, this calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number. I'll come back to that in a few moments. But in the first century, in first century Asia Minor, who were the main propagandists that supported the emperor? It was a group of priests, actually. It was a priesthood. Pagan priests, of course. It was the emperor cult, and they promoted worship of the emperor. Again, through propaganda. And they're the ones that sometimes would enforce it. You know, burn a little incense on the altar for Caesar, recognizing that the previous Caesars are now up there with the other gods, that sort of thing. Also, there was a second group that was in collusion with them, and it's called the Commune of Asia. And this was a group, a council, something like the city councils. Distinguished individuals, I guess you could say the elite of society. And one of their main purposes was to promote loyalty to the emperor. So the second beast, the propagandist, the one who promotes worship of the first beast, which we have identified as the Roman Empire in its original form, then must be this imperial cult and the other propagandists who were promoting emperor worship. Now, the Adventists believe that this second beast represents the United States of America because they think that a beast is always a nation in prophecy. There's all kinds of reasons for believing that. When did the United States appear in association with the end of this 1260-year period? So you see, there's all kinds of unproven assumptions here that a beast always represents a nation. That's not necessarily true. I can't find any principle anywhere that tells me that. And I'll bet you can't either. So anyhow, the second beast, I would say, my opinion, that represents in its original form the propagandists who promoted the worship and loyalty to the Roman Empire. Now, I'm talking original form here, not final manifestation. Also, I would say that this same system has had manifestations down through the centuries. It has them today, if you think about it. Totalitarians always enlist propagandists, don't they? You think they don't do that in communist countries? You think that doesn't happen in North Korea? It didn't happen in the Soviet Union? Big time it did. Think it doesn't happen in the Muslim world? Think it doesn't happen? You think it is not happening in the Western democracies to some extent today? I think it is. It's moving in that direction at least. But in any case, I'm not going to get into who's going to do what and when and where, because you know what? Back to my answer. I don't know. Don't know. Well, now let's look at this mark again and see if we can't sort through this and figure out what it is. So again, verse 17, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark. That is the name of the beast. Now, don't rely on your King James Version. This is the better translation. It says, so no one may buy or sell unless he has the mark, that is, which is the name of the beast. That's the mark of the beast. It is the name of the beast. One and the same thing. It's not something different. King James may lead you to think that you got three different things there. You got the mark, you got the number, you got the... No, no, this is all the same thing. The number is the number of his name. It represents his name too. But the mark of the beast is the name of the beast. That's what it says. I can't tell you what that name is, but I think I can take a pretty good guess at it. A semi-educated guess. And here it is. Let's read on. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. A man. So that tells us something right there, doesn't it? Not just a system. It's the number of a man. In other words, if you count up this number, looking at the numerical value of the letters used in his name, then you'll come up with the number 666. Now, I would say this, that in all probability, this was written during the reign of Domitian, which was late in the first century, in the 90s, and that these people were already familiar with who this was. Somebody that lived back earlier, that died, another emperor that died much earlier, back in the 60s. And that would have been Nero Caesar. And you can look at the word Nero Caesar and do the numerical count, and sure enough, it comes up 666. So I would submit this, that this was not something these people had no clue about, that they knew right away who it was because that was already in their thinking. They already referred to Nero Caesar as 666, and any emperor that came along after him that behaved as him concerning the saints and the people of God then would be considered a manifestation of that same system or that same evil that was present in Nero when he persecuted the Christians in Rome. Now, one of the reasons I do not believe that the book of Revelation was written in the 60s, as many people believe nowadays, that's a growing idea, very popular among some, is because if it was written in the 60s, then this is prior to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, and then Revelation 17 would fit very well apostate Jerusalem rather than Rome. And you can make the fit very well. It's even impressive. You see people who do that, see certain evangelicals who make that case, and it's pretty impressive. But the problem I have with that, and also the problem that I have with the idea that is speaking specifically about Nero Caesar and not someone who came after him, is because this letter, this prophecy, was given to the churches in Asia Minor. And Nero's persecutions were concentrated primarily in Rome. And if the great harlot is really apostate Jerusalem, then why wasn't this letter sent to the saints or the believers in Jerusalem? There were thousands of them in Judea. No, it was sent to Asia Minor. So it fits what was going on during the reign of Domitian because his persecutions, his activities did extend into their territory. In fact, according to one source, I can't really confirm this. Maybe you have heard this or can confirm it one way or the other, but in Asia Minor, allegedly, there was a big statue of Domitian placed there, and they were told to worship it. So that would pretty much fit. He makes an image to the beast and so on. But in any case, I do believe it was given, this prophecy came in the reign of Domitian, and this 666 refers back to Nero Caesar and is now manifest in Domitian. And as we have seen, it will be manifest in some way in the time of the end. And as I said, there have been manifestations of this down across the centuries. So rather than just identify one single source and say, this is it, there it is right there, it's over there, know which country, which people, who the name of the guy is, You see the same thing all over the world, don't you? You see it in communist systems. You see it in under Muslim rule. You see it in other places. You see it back in World War II, Adolf Hitler. You see it in the rise of, well, Marxism, as I said, communism. You see it everywhere. So this prophecy, this should be meaningful to all peoples, all believers living under those systems, because the whole point of the book of Revelation is to encourage those who are suffering persecution to continue in the faith and not give up. Now then, what about that argument about connecting the mark of the beast with God's sign, which is the Sabbath? Well, again, I like to read the text. I like to read the immediate text and see if there's a clue in the immediate text that compares the beast's mark with something else that pertains to God or to Christ. And you know what? There is. It's in there. Remember what we said the mark of the beast is, or what I didn't say it, the scripture said it. It's the name of the beast. Maybe in the form of a number, but it is the name of the beast. What does that mean? In the forehead or in the right hand? Well, first of all, it's obviously drawing, I would say obviously, drawing from the ancient practice of branding slaves. They actually branded slaves in their right hand or someplace on their body. Sometimes it was a tattoo, and it denoted ownership. So those who, the right hand, the forehead, that suggests the earning of wages, your power to earn a living, the right hand, and also the seat of the intellect, the forehead. And so these are people who had given their will over to the beast. Now then, there is the counter. This is the counterfeit, but here we're going to read in the text what God's mark is. Verse chapter 14. Then I looked, and behold, on Mount Zion stood the Lamb, and with him 144,000 who had his name, and the Father's name written on their foreheads. So what's the contrast here between those who have the beast's name and those who have the Father's and Christ's name written in their foreheads? In other words, these are people who had submitted their will to God, to Jesus Christ. They're followers of Christ. It's what it simply is. And whether this has anything to do with a computer chip, if it does, some kind of manifestation of this, somewhere along the way, maybe. But I certainly couldn't put that in the category of doctrine or something that I would hold to and put in any kind of prophetic scenario I might come up with. I'll just put it that way. It says, and I heard a voice from heaven like the roar of many waters and like the sound of loud thunder. The voice I heard was like the sound of harpists playing on their harps, and they were singing a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and before the elders. No one could learn that song except the 144,000 who had been redeemed from the earth. It is these who had not defiled themselves with women, for they were virgins. This is spiritually speaking, of course. It is these who followed the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been redeemed from mankind as first fruits of God and of the Lamb, and in their mouth was no lie was found, and they are blameless. So here they're contrasted with the followers of the beast, the people who have submitted to a system that is based on lies, based on blasphemy, based on persecution of the saints. In other words, an anti-Christ system. And so they have the name of the beast in their foreheads, which means they've given their will over to the beast. These have the name of Christ and of God in their foreheads, meaning they have given their will over to God. They have submitted to God's rule in their lives. Simply what it means. Now, let me give you my opinion. And again, this is not to take issue with anything that's been said in any literature, any of our literature, or any ministers, other ministers, not at all, but it's just my opinion. And that is that it's not necessary to think that there is an actual manifestation of some kind of actual mark or actual thing that's in order to fulfill this. Because this is symbolism. It's symbolism. And it speaks of the heart. It speaks of what's in the inside of the person. And those who submit themselves to the beast, I don't care if they have a computer chip or no computer chip, or a tattoo or no tattoo, or which day they keep, if they submit to the beast, they have received the mark on their hearts. And if they submit to God and to the Lamb, they've received the name, their name, into their hearts. Meaning, they've given themselves to them. They've submitted their wills to them. So this is the contrast you see here. And so I think anything outside what the text actually tells us is pure speculation and guesswork, and should not be it should not ever be, put it this way, this is the main point, should not ever be dogmatized and presented as something that's vital knowledge that we must know, because if we don't know what it is, when that time comes, we might accidentally receive it. No, we won't accidentally receive it. You cannot accidentally receive the mark of the beast. If you do, you haven't really received it. If it's some kind of outward sign. You cannot be forced upon you. The only way you receive the mark of the beast is to submit your will to the beast, which means you become non-submissive to God's rule in your life. That's why the description of the people of God is those who keep the commandments of God and hold the faith of Jesus. So if you want to mark, you want to avoid the mark of the beast, if there is such a thing in the future, an actual manifestation of something, then the only thing you need to worry about is not figuring out what that mark may consist of as far as a manifestation of it. But the only thing you need to be concerned with is keeping the commandments of God and holding strongly to the faith of Jesus no matter what happens along the way, no matter what you have to face in life. And then if you do that, then you are inoculated. You will not get the beast's virus. And that's the message of the book of Revelation. Again, in closing, here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints. Keep it. Keep that message. Keep it in your hearts. When the evil day comes, you will stand before God.